Concluding today's celebration of 20 years of Fresh Air as a national daily show, we have one more interview to replay from our first year. The late Larry Adler was the world's foremost harmonica virtuoso. He began his musical career in vaudeville and went on to play with such musicians and performers as George Gershwin, Fred Astaire, Jack Benny, and Duke Ellington. But Adler also was at home in the concert hall, performing Beethoven as well and as passionately as he performed pop and show tunes. Larry Adler died in 2001. When Terry spoke with him in 1987, he had just published his autobiography, It Ain't Necessarily So. Let's start with what Terry had to say about him.
It's been said of Adler's musicianship that what he can't do on the harmonica can't be done. And Adler has said of his own work that he would like his epitaph to repeat what Billie Holiday once said to him, "You don't play that thing, you sing it." Larry Adler, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm very ashamed of you. I may as well start off telling you right
now. Now what did I do?
Oh, you cleaned up the Billie Holiday story.
No, I know. I took out the expletive.
Yeah, you know, why can't we tell it this way? She heard me play with Duke Ellington, and then Duke took me over, and he said, "Larry, this is Billie Holiday." And I put out my hand to say, "How do you do?" And she says, "Man, you don't play that bleeping thing. You sing it." Now, you see, you can get it that way.
The way you tell it in your autobiography, you ran away from home when you were 14 in the hopes of joining Bora Minovich and his harmonica band. And I think it's a pretty brave thing to run away when you're 14. But why did you have to run away to do it?
Well, I certainly couldn't have gotten permission from my mother and father. They wouldn't let me at the age of 14 go to New York. And I wanted to get away. And I had won this mouth organ competition. I was Baltimore's mouth organ champion. I read in the paper, Lawrence Cecil Adler, this is the man you're talking to, is the champion of Baltimore, and boy, I believed it. Went right to my head, and I was stage struck. I'd seen Al Jolson, I'd seen Eddie Cantor, I'd also heard Rachmaninoff, I'd seen Otto Klemperer conduct. I wanted to do what they did, and the best way was to get on the stage somehow. Now, I had about $50 my parents didn't know about because I sold Liberty magazines. So simply, without telling them, I went down to Union Station in Baltimore, got on a train. I had met a musician named Nat Brusiloff, who'd made the great mistake of saying to me, "If you ever come to New York, kid, look me up." He didn't know, because I looked him up. And the poor man had to take care of me.
You were in vaudeville for quite a while. What was your act like, and what were some of the roles you had to take on in the act?
Well, it's a bit embarrassing, because when I first had this contract with Paramount, and I tried to do an act. Well, I didn't have an act. I didn't know how to do an act. And it was the comedian in the show. It was a traveling road show. He thought of the idea of making me a local boy. So in 44 cities, I was a local boy. I was a local boy in Philadelphia. I was a local boy in Chicago and Denver. And I used to get the most applause of anyone on the bill because this is our local boy. Give him a big hand. So the other act hated my guts, but there I was, local boy, making good. One thing that does puzzle me, in those days we did not use microphones, and there were stage bands. How in hell could they hear me? A mouth organ has very little projection power. And yet when I finished playing, they applauded. So do you suppose, and this is one theory, did they listen better in those days? Without the amplification, they would have to listen to hear the sound, and maybe that is the explanation.
Maybe that's it.
How did you break into pop music, an American popular song, playing Rodgers and Hart, meeting the Gershwins?
Well, mind you, look who was around in those days. Yeah. Not only Rodgers and Hart, Gershwin, Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen. These people were like Schubert and Mendelssohn. They just wrote wonderful things, and you wanted to play them. Now, I was in Gus Edwards' act. It was a kiddie act. And while I was with him at the Palace, Paul Whiteman was playing at the Roxy with his own film, The King of Jazz. And I was dying to have Whiteman listen to me. So between my shows, I would go up to the Roxy and stand outside the stage door, and whoever came in or out, I'd blow the mouth organ in their face, hoping someone said, "What a talented little boy this is." Well, finally someone did. Frankie Trumbauer, the very, very famous saxophone player, took me into Whiteman's dressing room. He says, "Paul, listen to this kid." So I played Poet and Peasant. And when I finished playing it, Whiteman said, "Let me hear you play the Rhapsody in Blue." I was 15. I couldn't handle the Rhapsody in Blue. But I was a very arrogant, snotty little kid, and success has not changed me. I couldn't let him know that I didn't know Rhapsody in Blue and that it was too tough for me. So I said, "I don't like Rhapsody in Blue." So he turns to a young man I hadn't noticed before, and he said, How do you like that, George? And that's how I met Gershwin.
Were you friends after that?
Well, that was the end of that, because I got out fast. All but right. However, about 3 years later, a man named Jules Glenzer, who was the vice president of Cartier, he gave me a farewell party. I was going to England for the first time. This was 1934. And at this party, there was Johnny Green, there was Harold Arlen, there was Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, and with them all, I played a song of theirs. Now, I knew that sooner or later I was going to play something with George, and then our host, Jules Glenzer, said, Larry and George are going to play the Rhapsody in Blue. Well, by now, I'd heard it so many times, it was in my head, and I've got a very good ear. If it's in my head, I can play it. So George sat at the piano, I started to play, and when we finished playing, George got up and he put his hand on my shoulder and he says, the goddamn thing sounds as if I wrote it for you. And in my act now, I have a piano roll made by George Gershwin. That is on that record also. And I put scotch tape over the melody line. It sounds literally as if Gershwin is accompanying me. It's wonderful, and it's an eerie feeling.
You toured with Jack Benny for a long time. Did you ever play music comedy with him? We all remember his attempts at being a violin virtuoso.
Well, we would do a duet together, and Jack would hit one note like this, then me on the mouth organ. Jack. Jack. All that one note. And it was very funny. And I probably learned as much from Jack Benny as one could learn from any individual performer because, first of all, he was an encyclopedia. And he gave me advice once in two words, which is the most valuable lesson I think you could ever learn in show business. And the two words are, don't press. And boy, that is a hard lesson to learn because if you're playing for an audience that doesn't like you, the impulse is work harder, win them over. He says do just the opposite, relax, wait for them to find you. Huh. Oh, it takes you a long time to learn that.
Well, he had some of the best timing in all of show business.
There is nothing like Jack's timing.
And one of the subtlest performers.
Yes. And also, he was one of the most considerate of people. See, I did three overseas tours with Jack Benny during World War II, and he encouraged me to do comedy. And if I got a bigger laugh than Jack, to him, that just made the show better. There's many a comedian I know who, if you got a bigger laugh than they, you were out. You were fired. That was not Jack's way.
We should talk about your classical music playing. We've talked a little bit about vaudeville and pop. When you play with an orchestra, the orchestra has to tune to you. Is that right?
Yes. Well, the only man who ever gave me a hard time was your own ex-conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony, Eugene Ormandy. There was the Ford Symphony Hour, and Mr. Ormandy was the conductor, and I was going to be the soloist playing the Vivaldi A minor concerto, the Vivaldi violin concerto. And I heard later he did not want to conduct for me at all, and he tried to get me canceled. But we each had a contract. Mine was as valid as his. Now, he rehearsed the orchestra and didn't let me come out until the last 10 minutes of rehearsal time, which was really awful. So I came out, and I gave my aid to the violinist, and Ormandy says, what is this? I said, well, you see, they have to tune to me. The mouth organ is the fixed reed. I cannot tune to them. He said, this is ridiculous. And I've never talked back to a conductor. I'm a coward anyway. But I said to him, Mr. Ormandy, I have played this work with this orchestra last year. If it embarrasses you to conduct it, I think we could do it without you.
Oh, I'm sure you got a great response to
that. Oh, the orchestra loved it.
Oh, dear.
Harmonica virtuoso Larry Adler speaking with Terry Gross in 1987.